All right, we're in the Fitz News Studios. A big week, folks. We're going to dig into it. The Murdoch murders, crime and corruption saga, probably the biggest week for news of this story since it broke last June, people. Just a huge, huge week of news. We're going to get into all the latest developments on that case and assess their impact, particularly on the double homicide trial of Alec Murdoch, which has been set for January of next year. Also, major developments in the Cheer Incorporated scandal, people. We've got not only new lawsuits to discuss, but a response from one of the major corporate defendants, which I address in detail in this episode. All that's coming your way on The Week in Review. All right, so for the last few weeks, it had been very quiet on the Murdoch murders, crime, and corruption front. Too quiet. But that changed last week when this news outlet filed an exclusive report detailing a bombshell development in the federal criminal case. Now, again, only one person has been charged so far federally in connection with this multi-layered, multifaceted maze of alleged criminality. And that individual is Russell Lafitte, the former president of Palmetto State Bank, the Hampton, South Carolina bank, which, according to both state and federal prosecutors, was a key cog in the web of financial criminality allegedly masterminded by Alec Murdoch. But was Alec Murdoch really the mastermind of this financial criminality? Well, after last week, that is very much in question. Why? Because, folks, Russell Lafitte made a recording which would point to a broader network of alleged conspirators. Now, on this recording, which was reportedly made during a board meeting of Palmetto State Bank, discussions were had over a check tied to one of the alleged fleecings committed by Alec Murdoch and his network. Now, on the same week that that development was made public, a lawsuit was filed in civil court down in the 14th Judicial Circuit, alleging that additional attorneys tied to Murdoch's former law firm, the PMPED law firm there in Hampton, South Carolina, now it goes by a different name, but at the time that was what it was called, additional attorneys were linked to criminal activity, again, tied to the very same type of crime, fleecing people out of settlement money, a pattern, a RICO pattern, again, if you will. Why RICO charges haven't been filed in this case, I don't know, because there's clearly a pattern of similar criminal activity, again, according to both state and federal prosecutors. But this development was huge for a number of reasons. Obviously, this news outlet from the very beginning has doubted the contention that Alec Murdoch and Russell Lafitte put this whole plan together on their own or implemented it on their own. Clearly, that seems like a stretch, right? Given the depth, the intricacy, the breadth of these crimes, it just seems difficult to accept that two people, particularly these two, could have pulled it off. But it wasn't just the expansion of the federal criminal case, which, by the way, we learned just this week, there's not just one recording, folks. Russell Lafitte was, in the words of attorney Eric Bland, a serial taper. Multiple tapes, multiple recordings made in connection with this case. Now, here's my question. Do prosecutors on the federal side who have multiple conflicts of interest in this case, again, exclusively reported by this news outlet last fall, are they serious about getting to the bottom of this case? We don't know. What we've seen so far is troubling. In fact, what we've seen is one of the conflicted attorneys, Kara Henderson, whose father works at the very law firm that Alec Murdoch worked at, and who worked alongside Murdoch in the 14th Circuit, both of them working for Solicitor Duffy Stone down there in the 14th Circuit. So, two conflicts with her. Two conflicts. She is sitting in the courtroom on the prosecution side. Just unbelievable. We also learned last week that the judge in this case, and again, I don't think this was intentional. I think the judge in this case, Richard Gergel, is an honorable guy, a good judge, fair judge. But he did not put the hearing about the initial recording on the public docket, which is totally inexcusable. For a case of this magnitude, a case that is this high profile, to hold a hearing in secret, I had other reporters call me saying, hey, your report's wrong. There's no hearing. Judge isn't holding a hearing. Well, guess what? There was a hearing. He just didn't put it on the docket. Wait until afterward to indicate that there was a hearing held on those tapes. Again, totally unacceptable in a case of this magnitude, in any case, but particularly in a case of this magnitude where the public faith in the integrity of this investigation has already been called into question and where there are clear conflicts on the part of the prosecutors. But again, we thought that was the big news this week in the Murdoch saga, folks. We thought the existence of these additional recordings and the drama on the federal side, we thought that was the big news. But little did we know, a lot more was coming. And I want to talk about that now. As we tape this, we don't know exactly when Alec Murdoch's murder trial will be held. And I want to explain this. Yesterday, the Charleston Post and Courier exclusively reported that a trial date had been set for January the 30th. Our news outlet, 2 minutes later or 3 minutes later, same report, same sources, based on an order that was submitted October 11, signed by Judge Bentley Price, who, if you follow Fitz News, you know a little bit about Bentley Price. But an order was signed which indicated that the murder trial for Alec Murdoch would be held January 30th through February 17th. Signed order. Well, guess what, folks? That order was never filed. We found out just as we went to tape this episode that a new order dated October 13, signed by Judge Bentley Price, had set the trial for January 23rd to February 10. So when is the trial? Well, we reached out to the Office of the Attorney General. We reached out to the defense attorneys for Alec Murdoch. And guess what, folks? No one knows. How's that for a auspicious start to these proceedings, folks? If we do get a date certain for this trial, we'll be sure to let you know. But clearly, it's either January 23rd or January 30th. I would put my money on January 23rd because that was the order that was actually signed and filed in Collin County Court on Friday, just yesterday. So we'll continue to keep tabs on that. When we get a solid date, we'll let you know. But that was big news, obviously, the fact that the trial will be happening at some point in late January. But again, the expansion of the federal case and the setting of a date certain for this trial, believe it or not, those weren't even the biggest news in the Murdoch story this week. The big news happened Friday afternoon, hit like a thunderbolt out of the blue. A filing from defense attorneys Dick Harpootlian and Jim Griffin, in which it was alleged that Curtis Edward Smith, who, if you follow this case, you know Cousin Eddie very well, been accused of drug charges, been accused of fraud charges connected with cash and checks for Alec Murdoch, most notoriously been accused of shooting Alec Murdoch in the head in connection with this bizarre roadside shooting that took place last Labor Day, allegedly part of an insurance scam to route a $10 million payout to Murdoch's son, Buster Murdoch. Cousin Eddie facing multiple charges in connection with that roadside shooting. In fact, those were the first charges filed in any of these Murdoch cases. So he's the original defendant zero, if you will, in the Murdoch crime and corruption saga, Eddie Smith. He's been incarcerated since August, mid-August, after his bond was revoked by Judge Clifton Newman. But as we went to press, airing this episode, late Friday afternoon, again, a thunderbolt out of the blue, the defense attorneys filed a motion alleging that Eddie Smith failed a polygraph. And not just any polygraph, a polygraph asking him specific questions about his alleged involvement in the Mazell homicides. And this is important. I want to rewind this here for a second. Up to this point, not only have there been no charges connected to this double homicide other than the two murder charges and the weapons charges against Alec Murdoch, but on repeated occasions, this news outlet has gone to its trusted network of law enforcement and prosecutorial sources and asked repeatedly, was anybody else involved? Any accomplices? In fact, most recently in late August, when there was a high-profile search of the Saucahatchie River, which we know was tied to this investigation, we asked again, any connections, any accomplices? We're hearing there are. In fact, we heard some very specific information about Eddie Smith related to Mazell months ago. We're told there was no truth to it. But we now learn that on May the 5th, 2022, around the time we were asking a lot of these questions, a polygraph exam was administered to Smith by agents of the South Carolina State Law Enforcement Division. Smith was asked directly whether he had any involvement with the murders at Moselle, whether he committed the murders at Moselle, and specifically whether he committed the murders at Moselle on the date they occurred, June 7 of last year. And guess what, folks? Deception was indicated in his response to all of those questions, according to the filing submitted by Alec Murdoch's attorneys. A significant, people. A significant. Now, do I believe Eddie Smith was involved in the murders? Don't know, folks. Again, up to this point, every bit of evidence that's been leaked, that's been discussed, that's been talked about publicly, has all tied back to Alec Murdoch, to one person. And certainly it makes sense for a guy who's getting ready to stand trial on two murder charges to throw something against the wall, see if it sticks. That's a natural defense mechanism. In fact, we're going to talk about that in our upcoming segment on another case. It's natural to find a defense mechanism like that. But we've confirmed through our network of law enforcement sources that Smith indeed was given a polygraph and that he indeed failed that polygraph. And that failure was indeed tied to the very questions which were listed in the motion filed by Harpootlian and Griffin yesterday. So again, the defense attorneys, they've taken a lot of heat in this case, and deservedly so. They fumbled and bumbled their way through the early months of it, but they're not pulling this out of their backsides, people. Our law enforcement sources have confirmed that that information in the filing is accurate. So where does this leave us? Well, the defense attorneys made a good point. They raised in their filing, they said, look, if you're going to rely on Cousin Eddie as a witness against Alec Murdoch, good luck. Good luck based on this evidence. But again, the real question is, did Alec Murdoch have help? On the night of the murder, this news outlet heard from multiple local sources claiming that they recognized certain vehicles going to and from Moselle. And again, we've waited months, asked multiple times, this person. We've heard about phones being turned off the night of those murders, and that there was a certain individual who was smart enough to turn their phone off the night of those murders. Again, asking these questions from the beginning. No answers. From the beginning, it's been one answer. One guy, Alec Murdoch. And again, that may very well be true. Not saying it isn't true. We've seen nothing so far to suggest that the investigation isn't being conducted with integrity, isn't being conducted professionally. But this is a serious question. This is a serious challenge. In fact, this is probably the biggest challenge this prosecution is facing so far in this case. Because two things here. Either you've got a co-conspirator, number one, or one of your star witnesses is shot. Either way, significantly damaging to the prosecution, this development. I've also been told that Harpootlian and Griffin had been holding on to this little thunderbolt for some time. Why they decided to release it this particular Friday afternoon, don't know. I reached out to Senator Harpootlian. He declined to discuss the filing, wouldn't even provide a copy. Said we'd had to go get it from the Colleton courthouse. So tight-lipped on that, but again, a major development in this case, folks. Huge week on the Murdoch front. Where does it go from here? Well, first we got to find out when the trial is going to be held, people. We'll get to that. We're going to try to get some clarity on that as we deal with these conflicting orders from Judge Bentley Price. But as soon as we get an answer to that, we'll let you know. But more importantly, keep it tuned here as we continue to dig deep into all the developments, not only on the criminal side, but also on the civil side, where Murdoch and multiple defendants are facing any number of cases tied to any number of alleged fleecings. It's just a huge mess, people. Probably the biggest criminal saga South Carolina has ever seen. But again, you want to keep up on it, the latest, not only the breaking news, folks, but the analysis. Keep it tuned to Fitz News, where we will satisfy your need for the Murdoch fix. All right, so in addition to all the Murdoch news, it was another big week in the Cheer Incorporated scandal. Multiple lawsuits, three new lawsuits to be precise, were filed in U.S. District Court in Greenville, South Carolina. These obviously coming on the heels of the major federal lawsuit filed in Tennessee, as well as the initial federal lawsuit filed in Greenville. And again, the origin point for all of this, the August 22 death by suicide of Scott Foster, the former owner and founder of the Rockstar Cheer Gym up in Greenville, South Carolina, stands accused of multiple instances of alleged inappropriate sexual contact with both male and female cheer athletes, many of them underage at the time the alleged abuse occurred. Foster, obviously not the only one implicated in this saga. There are multiple cheer coaches, not just from the Rockstar Gym, but at multiple gyms across the country who've been implicated in connection with this case. Not only that, we're looking at lawsuits coming, more lawsuits in Tennessee, South Carolina, also new suits coming apparently in Georgia, North Carolina, Florida, Maryland, perhaps even other states. This is just a huge scandal, folks. Again, as we've repeatedly reported, an epidemic of alleged sex abuse within the American cheerleading industry. And by the way, we're going to get to one of the responses from the titan of that industry in a moment. But before that, wanted to touch just briefly on some of the new developments in the new lawsuits that were filed this week. Obviously, we've covered the initial South Carolina complaint and the Tennessee complaint in some detail. But this complaint, the three new complaints filed in South Carolina this week, has some interesting new developments. Our researcher, Jen Wood, dug deep on those documents and found some very interesting things we hadn't seen in the prior suits, particularly related to Charles Bank, which is the company that sold most of its interest in Varsity, but maintained some of its interest back in 2018 when Varsity was purchased by Bain Capital, the firm up there in Massachusetts, founded by former presidential candidate, current U.S. Senator Mitt Romney. Now, one of the points made in the new lawsuits is that Charles Bank made a conscious decision, that's quoting from the lawsuit, a conscious decision at the time of the Bain transaction to retain an ownership interest in Varsity. Now, their point in making that allegation is very simple, that both Bain and Charles Bank should have done due diligence at the time. Because if you'll remember, if you followed Fitz News and our reporting on this, if you've read our report about the loopholes within these governing bodies that were supposed to be protecting athletes, these entities which are, by the way, controlled by Varsity, you'll recall that the allegations against Scott Foster, the first ones that bubbled up to Varsity, that bubbled up to the U.S. All-Star Federation, we're talking about late 2017, folks, and we're talking about a suspension of Foster. Again, a suspension in name only if you go back and look at what actually happened. But that happened right at the time that Varsity was being sold to Bain. So again, a very pivotal time for the company, a very pivotal moment in its evolution. Billions of dollars at stake, people. Again, this was a nearly $3 billion sale. And again, the contention of these attorneys is that nothing could have been left to chance in that sale, in that transaction, and that the companies that purchased Varsity should have known that this culture of abuse existed and that the enforcement mechanisms that, again, Varsity controlled, they had a majority of seats on the USASF All-Star Governing Board, that they should have been aware of what was happening and that they were protecting, coddling, enabling abusers. Again, that's the theory of this lawsuit. So again, it's not just individual abusers like Scott Foster. It's not just the gyms which employed them and allowed them access to underage children. But according to these lawsuits, it's a much bigger culture of abuse, which includes Varsity, which includes the USASF, and which includes those two fiscal giants, Charles Bank and Bain Capital, which, again, should have known better according to the lawsuits. Now, obviously, a lot of this we've known, new details in these suits, but the general structure, the scope of defendants, we've known. But there was a new wrinkle in these new South Carolina lawsuits that were filed this week in the Cheer Incorporated scandal, and it involves parents. Up to this point, that's been part of the missing equation, if you will. We know that parents have been participants in some of these legal actions protecting their children, but according to this lawsuit, there were some parents who weren't protecting their children. In fact, according to these lawsuits, there were parents actively participating in providing drugs, in engaging in inappropriate sexual conduct, all manner of alleged abuses tied to this scandal. Now, as we continue to dig into this story, well, here's something I want to promise you. And I've said this before. We've got open microphones here at Fitz News, and we're going to talk about that extensively in the next segment. But I want to tell you something else. As we dig into these allegations about the culture and about, again, parents allegedly participating, this news outlet is going to be committed to doing our very best to separate the wheat from the chaff, if you will, because at the very beginning of this story, when the first lawsuits began to be filed, we were warned, be careful. Some of the parents crying wolf now were in the middle of this. Some of the folks who are now claiming to be victims or survivors were in the middle of this. And this website is going to do its level best to make sure that as we bring you all these stories, and as we continue to host this conversation moving forward, that we do our very best to figure out exactly who's telling the truth, who was legitimately victimized by this system, and again, perhaps some of these parents who may, according to these lawsuits, have participated in the exploitation. All right, so in addition to the new lawsuits, there were some other developments in the Cheer Incorporated scandal this week, and I'm talking specifically about a response to the scandal by Varsity. And again, this is the major corporate entity that dominates the business side of Cheer, that dominates the regulatory side of Cheer, which was purchased back in 2018 by Bain Capital for nearly $3 billion. This is the 400-pound gorilla, the dominant force in the Cheer industry. Now, Varsity is a defendant in all of these federal lawsuits, which have been filed by the Strom Law attorneys. And so Varsity obviously has an interest in defending itself, but the statement that the company released late Thursday evening is deserving of some attention. It's deserving of some analysis. And so I want to just get into that a little bit. I'm looking at the statement here on my phone as it was tweeted. It was actually not posted to Varsity's website. It was sent out through a 14-tweet thread on the social media platform. But I wanted to go through it. There were some things, we've all heard before that, the alleged behavior is abhorrent and unforgivable, according to Varsity, that, they're committed to the safety of athletes and all that, that they want the fullest extent of the law, for those who are implicated in some of these allegations. But there was some other language that's interesting. It talked about how there were bad actors in every sport, and that Varsity was committing to rooting out those bad actors. But here's the part of the statement that I thought was most compelling, most important. And I think this is really the only part of the statement that Varsity wanted us to hear, wanted victims to hear, survivors to hear, and the attorneys pushing these cases to hear. And I quote, "We have a responsibility to defend Varsity Spirit against any false or misleading claims that may jeopardize hardworking athletes and the future of our sport, and we intend to do so vigorously. We are exploring all avenues, including legal measures, to defend ourselves from any false narrative that erroneously suggests Varsity Spirit somehow willfully turned a blind eye to misconduct and cheer as part of a broader conspiracy. The truth matters for the survivors and for the support. The safety of well-being of the athletes and the fight to hold wrongdoers accountable must not be jeopardized or distracted by reckless mischaracterizations and falsehoods. The survivors, more than anyone, deserve a full and complete factual record on which to pursue justice." Now, I want to dive into this a little bit because certainly, as I noted in my coverage of this, my response to this statement, Varsity does have a right to defend itself. Varsity does, in fact, have an obligation, and as its spokesman said, its president, that statement was from Bill Seeley, Varsity's president, as Seeley said, it has a responsibility to defend itself. But here's where I draw the line on this statement, and here's where I think that this statement was just ridiculously sanctimonious and self-serving. It's this notion that Varsity is doing this for the athletes, for the survivors, for the integrity of the sport. No, not even a little bit. Varsity is doing this to cover its ass, to protect its profits, and it's doing it to shift the onus of this away from itself. Now, again, it has every right to do that. My news outlet will continue as it holds an open microphone out for anyone and everyone with a say on this case to have their say. We're going to continue to do that. In fact, my news outlet has printed letters to the editor from people saying that Varsity and some of the others involved in this case were being treated unfairly. So not only are we going to print what they say, we're going to print people defending them. But again, when they issue statements like this, pure self-serving pablum like this, we also have an obligation to say what we think about it. And I'm going to tell you what I think about it. I think it's absolute crap for this company to try to take this scandal and somehow portray itself as doing something altruistic on behalf of these victims and survivors. So it is claiming that its self-serving, profit-protecting PR statement here is somehow intended to protect the integrity of the sport? No. Again, hell no. Hell no. This was a threat. Okay? That's how I perceive it anyway. This was a threat against people who might want to stand up and tell their stories, against gym owners who might want to come clean about what they've witnessed, about parents who might want to pursue justice for what's happened to their kids, and frankly, against the news media for reporting on it. This was a threat, and all of that flowery language about the integrity of the sport and Varsity's commitments to this, that, or the other, that's not what that statement was about. That was filler, folks. That was fluff. That statement was a threat. That statement was a threat. It was about communicating to anyone who's involved in this case, you better shut up. You better keep your mouth shut or we're going to sue you. We're going to sue you. Now, I reached out to one of the Jane Does who's been very vocal, who's published anonymous columns on our news outlet relating to this. And again, her columns haven't called anyone at Varsity out particularly, or they haven't. They've just simply explained how she feels about what happened to her. That's it. But I shared this response with her. And I asked her what she thought about it. You know what she said? She said it's going to encourage her to keep writing. It's going to encourage her to keep writing. You know what I wrote? Me too, Jane. Me too. Because a threat like this is exactly what a bully does. And I'll tell you something else. Having been on the receiving end of libel suits in the past, if you've got a case, folks, you don't go to the public and say, oh, I'm going to sue somebody. You know, oh, you say bad things about me, I'm going to sue you. No, you just file your suit and let the facts speak for themselves. That's what you do. You don't go on Twitter and threaten people. In fact, the fact that a multi-billion-dollar company thinks the best way to defend itself in this case is to go on Twitter and threaten people, I think that says a lot about this case. Now, again, even if Varsity is in this threatening posture, even if Varsity specifically threatens this news outlet, threatens me personally, guess what? We're still going to turn the mic over to them because they have a voice in this process, and that voice deserves to be heard. That's the way our system works, people. And again, my news outlet will always turn this mic not only over to the victims and survivors, but to those accused. Because again, that's the way we do it in this country, or the way we should do it. But if Varsity thinks for one second that it can throw this kind of crap up against the wall and hope it sticks, and that no one's going to call them on it, that they're going to shroud their PR defensive in the integrity of the sport and the suffering of these survivors, and somehow claim they're doing it for them, nah, we're not going to let that pitch go by. Hell no. That is a big, fat softball right over the middle of the plate, and I'm going to tattoo that pitch every time. Every time. But again, this news outlet from the beginning has been committed to advancing the conversation on this issue, on the epidemic of sex abuse within the cheerleading industry, giving voice to victims, giving voice to survivors, their families, exposing the loopholes in the industry that led to this, the lack of accountability and oversight from the entities Varsity controls. Again, got to point that out. Varsity, you didn't mention that in your statement. But as we continue down that road, there's one part of the Varsity statement I do think is worth noting out. They said in that statement that the truth matters. And on that, I agree with Bill Seeley, the president of Varsity, 100%. The truth does matter. It does matter. And that's what we're going to continue to pursue at Fitz News, no matter who threatens us. All right, that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Week in Review. Thank you for joining us. Lots of big news, obviously, this week. Before I go, though, I want to plug it one more time. Cheer Incorporated, our podcast devoted to this still unfolding saga, a deeper look, a detailed look, a victim's perspective, narrated by our director of research, Jen Wood, produced by our director of special projects, Dylan Nolan. Please check it out on Apple, on Spotify, wherever you download podcasts. If you like what you hear, please submit a review. Most importantly, though, share it with a friend. Share it with a parent. Share it with somebody you know and love. And if you're concerned about where this country's going and how it treats future generations, Cheer Incorporated, a must listen to. Once again, thanks for tuning into The Week in Review. We will catch you next time.